So I had to look at all my cables, all my interconnects, my Amphenol barrel connector, other connectors, and finally got the results that I wanted. But it was all trial and error.
Well, yeah, I mean, theoretically, I guess if you ran a VNA on everything, you might be able to calculate on a Smith chart. But then you'd also need to have run your antenna tuner enough to generate a Smith chart with allowable impedances. So it's theoretically capable of being measured to a degree. But it's a lot of work that most people wouldn't be interested in doing. So, yeah, it degenerates into something where you just have to try stuff out. You know, you have a couple of jumpers available, and you use them. You see if you could match with them, and eventually if you find something that works, you scribble it down someplace for the next time.
QSL. And the other thing, too, when it rains, when there's a lot of precipitation, that, you know, that affects the performance of the antenna overall, so that certain frequencies don't allow for transmission with at least 2-to-1 SWR, and the tuner can't tune it for some reason, you know? And every time I have that problem, and I do get it sometimes, I look out the window and see if it's raining.
Yeah, I agree with you. We both have fan dipoles, and fan dipoles especially. I've come to the conclusion that the humidity and other factors between the elements will cause a slight shift in their coupling, and so their resonant frequencies will drift a little bit, not severe in general, but, and sometimes if you're just at this cusp of impedance that your antenna tuner can take, and it just veers a little bit off of it, yeah, it could wreck you. But I had a kind of ongoing disagreement in general with Dick about that. I think he kind of was thinking more in terms of non-fan dipoles that are, I think, somewhat less sensitive to weather conditions than I think fan dipoles tend to be, because their elements are so close, and so the dielectric between them, if you change it a little bit, you're gonna have coupling problems, I would think.
QSL, the rain, and also snow and ice, and sometimes the antenna slightly misadjusts itself. Maybe it's hanging, you know, a little bit lower than it should. And, of course, you know, if I'm not getting the results that I want, and I know what the antenna is capable of doing, you know, I have to go up there and adjust it.
Well, yeah, if you're lucky enough to be able to have easy access, that's always something. You know, with fan dipoles, I find that a lot of people at first kind of think they're magic and don't really kind of tune them. It's always a good practice to decide on what part of the band is important to you and try as best you can to shorten elements and try and get it to exactly where you want it, because out of the box, a lot of times fan dipoles are kind of designed a little bit too long, because, you know, it's easier to fold something over than it is to add something onto it. So that's something newbie guys who haven't ever used fan dipoles should make sure that they make themselves aware of.
QSL. Yeah, I adjusted each leg of the dipole for the single sideband portion of each band. And I don't know if this is advisable, but I was told that I could add more legs to the dipole. Like I could add 17 meters and 6 meters if I want. And 17 meters works really well.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no inherent limitation that I'm aware of in how many legs you can make a fan dipole. You have to understand the mechanical complications that you now have a bigger, heavier, wider object, and keep that in mind for wind loading and other things. Also, as you add other elements, you're going to inevitably untune the other elements because they all kind of couple to a degree and interact. And so you might, if you decide that you're going to add an additional fan element, you probably will have to tweak the other fan lengths as well.
KD2FIU, I very carefully measured the distance between the top leg, which is 20 meters and 40 meters with a coil. I think it's 3 or 3.5 inches to 15 meters, 3.5 inches to 10 meters, and 3.5 inches to 17 meters. And the end is like maybe a foot and a half away from the end of the other part of the antenna. It seems to work okay.
Okay, whatever works for you. I mean, I basically just ran a VNA repeatedly, and that's how I came to my adjustments. And I, along with you, I prefer the phone end. So I always favor the high end of each band because of that, except for 10 meters, where a large stretch of it is phone. So I kind of tuned it for the 10-meter net that I run over a 28.380. But otherwise, yeah, I also kind of favored the higher frequency phone line, phone bands.
KD2FIU?
Yes, George.
I read a lot about this over the last 10 years. And I found in looking at information that came my way from articles or books written by antenna designers that to go to many bands, let's say beyond 3 bands expected of a single antenna, the best way to go with 2 or 3 bands was the trap antenna versus the fan dipole. The coupling would cause greater problems than the losses incurred with trapping networks. If the trapping networks were designed to provide a high level of inductance to the next band, lower band, and the greatest capacitance to actually arrest it and seal it at the one level that you want before you go to the next length of element, it was far more efficient than dealing with the interaction between the antenna that was fanned. The coupling with the fanning of the antenna itself created more harmonics that were undesirable. And I read this in many books, many articles over the years. And by the way, most of this was designed in the late 1940s and early 1950s. And probably through the late 1950s, a good 10, 12-year period. This information that I got, I found very valuable. KD2FIU.
AC2GS. Well, that's interesting, and I'll have to do a little bit of research on that. I was unaware that it produces harmonics. I'm not quite sure what the nature of those harmonics would be and why the coupling elements would do that, because, you know, there's a lot of antenna design that has even parasitic unconnected elements, and They don't really introduce harmonics. They might introduce phase distortion, depending upon their length, but I don't know about harmonics. So I'll have to give it a look. I've had a great time with fan dipoles myself personally. It's gotten me what I needed. They're small, they're compact. You don't have to clean the traps. Bugs don't get into them. So it works for me, but I'm glad traps work for you.
Harmonics and non-linearity go together. You have neither or you have both.
No bugs if you have high-quality traps that can handle it. People don't understand traps are not traps until they're made well.
Sounds to me like you're having a problem with something knocking over. That's a nice non-linearity. We'll give you harmonics. Any inductor or capacitor, if it's not doing something stupid like knocking over, cannot create harmonics.
You know, I saw a great-looking trap antenna made by a German company. I mentioned this a while back.
Yes, you want to expand upon that, David?
Sure, sure. Name of the company is called Calumet. Calumet. And they give you lots of choices, like what bands you want to have and how long the antenna is. Some of them are shortened for saving space. And the traps are Teflon-coated, so they say that they're very weather-resistant, and they're kind of expensive, and I'm wondering if anybody can buy them in the United States. So far, my fan dipole seems to work okay. I don't know if I need to replace it yet. And it's been about 6 or 7 years.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George. I just want to point out that, you know, I mean, unless there's some kind of wacky thing going on, fan dipoles kind of have a relatively long life because there's nothing really to break. I mean, it's just a bunch of wires connected. So unless the connections break, it's usually good. But I would assume Calumet is a German design, so it's probably really well built and really expensive. You might need to actually import it, but you might find it on eBay. You never know. But George, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, and understand the of course, we understand the idea of the trap is to kill the first highest level frequency that you want to resonate at that point, and then inductively resonate to the next frequency that you want, and then kill it at the next point after that, and inductively resonate at further frequencies. It's been understood for many years, and it's been attempted to go beyond three frequencies with a trap, that being the inductive load with the capacitive trapping, kill it there, the inductive load with the capacitive trapping, and kill it there, and then have a tail to resonate the final frequency. It's how you build it. It's how you make it work. Electrically, you can say, okay, these circuits need to be applied. Mechanically, how you build it to make it realize in weather and durability is a totally different thing. This is very different from a fan dipole's negative effects on having, let's say, three bands that you want to resonate, high, middle, and low, on the same type of antenna. My experience is a high-quality trap is far superior.
KG2R1.
Yeah, David, one sec. Just to point out that the fan dipole that I think I use and that David uses is a four-element, five-band design. But please, David, tell us.
what George is saying. You have to make it work. So you can make a trap antenna work. You can make a rotatable trap antenna work. And you can also make a fan dipole work.
Okay, I agree. Most of these designs work. I don't know of anything other than dummy loads that don't work to one degree or another. Everything has their pluses and minuses. In a perfect universe, we'd all have a couple of towers right out from our house, 200 feet with stacks of phased arrays of multi-band Yagis on nice sturdy rotators, and we could be the big guys, but the heavy guns, but we all come up with our interesting little compromises. I use my fan dipole. I have a vertical. Different people, George has traps. They're all good. I mean, some people favor different things, but that's the nature of human beings.
QSL. Well, yeah, you just got to make it work. But then tell me, Roy, why is it so many times these guys with the big stations, they get angry when I tell them I'm running 100 watts, a dipole, and a hand mic?
Well, I don't want to psychoanalyze people, but I would assume it's probably because they've dropped about $30,000 on their setup.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George?
Are they angry? I mean, they should be happy they made contact with you.
No, I asked the question, why would somebody get angry? They have a big antenna way high up in the air, an OptiBeam or something like that, a kilowatt and a half, and, very expensive radio. And I tell them I have an IC718, 100 watts, a wire, and a stock mic.
Two possibilities, David. Either they're very, very sensitive, it has nothing to do with you, or you're insulting them and aren't telling us that.
No, not at all. I have a lot of respect for people who have the big station, But a lot of times they think that, if I'm not spending the money and making the effort to have a station like them, a big station, then they think that they'll just be, but who is this guy? He's calling us 100 watts and a hand mic.
Sounds to me like a real snowflake. What do you think, Roy?
Again, secondhand, understanding people's psychiatric problems, you never know. Some people are short-tempered. Some people are charming and happy and friendly all the time. And some people are just curmudgeons, and most of us are someplace in the middle. So I don't know. Maybe he had an argument with the missus or something. You never know. These guys with the big iron tend to identify with other guys with a big iron, and so if you're using a less expensive setup. I could see where they could rationalize that they're doing the heavy lifting for you, and why am I spending $30,000 to talk to you, and you're not spending $30,000 to talk to me? But again, this is all conjecture. I don't know these guys. I wish everyone well. Once again, this is a hobby. If you're not having fun, it's the wrong hobby.
Well, I thank them. I thank them for the excellent QSO at the end of our conversation. And I also say I'm very thankful for the propagation that allows for us to have this QSO.
Okay. I've had many different conversations with a range of emotional types of people. Curious people, totally non-curious people, kind of matter-of-fact, give me your call sign, give me your signal report, give me your location. Okay, it's been loads of fun. We'll talk again in about 20 years. You know, everyone's different. So you got to take people as individuals, not as groups of classes. So I don't think all heavy iron guys are kind of that way. At least I haven't experienced that. I've had very pleasant conversations with guys down in Florida who inevitably have had towers and beams pointed at me. You know, it's been fun times for me.
Ham radio is a fantastic hobby.
Well, agreed. And that's sort of why we're all here tonight, to kind of talk about it and aspects of it. It is a deep and a broad hobby. If you don't like one thing, you can find 25 other things. And you can do it superficially or you can do it deep. There are some guys out there, the hobby for them is a couple of Baofengs stuck on their belt. And if that's all that they want, then so be it. And other guys are sitting around building all kinds of wonderful little interfaces for their radios and building all kinds of esoteric antenna designs. So it's a great hobby for a curious individual. We have members who aren't curious, and that's fine. If you just want to discuss what you had for breakfast, then so be it.
QSO. Well, on a nice day, a Baofeng in the park, nice long QSO with somebody across town. You know, I think that's like the greatest thing.
Well, yeah, but like anything, you wouldn't want a straight diet of vanilla ice cream day in and day out. You need a little variation in life. And there are some people out there who don't have any other radio but a Baofeng, not because they can't afford it, but because they don't see the point. So they buy a bunch of Baofengs. I knew one guy who bizarrely, I think he had over a dozen Baofeng radios, which I'm not quite sure what you do with a dozen of those things. But you know, again, whatever amuses you. That's the point of the hobby. You know, I hate people with clipboards who are making assessments of who's a real ham and who isn't a real ham.
KD2FIU.
Seriously, that, Roy.
KD2FIU.
Okay, Ed first, then you, George.
Very quick. The Baofengs do not have a reputation for being rugged or lasting a long time. So maybe this fellow knows that, and he has the money. He just buys a batch of them as disposables.
Okay, but he wears them sort of together. Now, I don't think all dozen, but he wears more than a few. So, you know, that's a possibility. I don't know. George, what do you want to say?
Back to the concept of antennas. The concept of coupling can really alter an antenna for benefit, or it could degrade the antenna. And what I have learned about the fan dipole is where it actually degrades it a bit. But if you go into capacitive end fed vertical dipoles, the concept of the actual field changing by the rods. Let's go into the GAP. GAP has the best design. I couldn't think of the name right there. They actually use it to the benefit in their design in vertical dipoles, so that you have the engineering that was precisely done. GAP is not just center-fed. Some models are end-fed. Some models are end-fed both ends, one end only. So what they were doing with this was the field of energy was either canceling or enhancing by near-end cancellation and near-end amplification. So I'm not knocking the dipole that is...
Yeah, George, apparently you fell out of the repeater. I don't know if you're aware of this.
Hey, Roy, I have something somewhat humorous, a little off the cuff. I think it's time for Paul anyway. Should I say it?
Roy.
Yeah?
Power supply shut down. I'll be back right away. Bye.
Okay, very good. I really want to move on to Paul. How long is would this thing be, Ed?
30 seconds.
Okay, I think Paul will agree to 30 seconds.
Yeah, my power supply shut down. It was actually failing me, and that's why I was not able to finish what I was saying. Thank you.
Yeah, George. Now, very, very quick. The ultimate antenna problem. Most large airplanes, particularly those that fly overseas, have an HF radio capability. The antenna on an airplane is when they're designing the airplane, they poke a hole through the top of the plane over the flight deck, put a feed through there, put an insulator on the top of the tail, and they run a wire between the two. And you have a wire of this completely random length that you have zero control over, and the frame of the plane, and the rest of it is, you figure it out, you deal with it.
Okay, I assume they have something like an impedance matching device, an antenna tuner.
Well, you got to shelf the bolt down something. Once you bolt down, is your problem.
Okay.
Well, that's it.
Okay, very good, Ed. Thank you. And thanks to George and everyone else and David. And John and all the people I forget who participated tonight, I really appreciate it. You guys, like I always say, make or break a technical net. Otherwise, it's just me babbling along, and no one wants that, including me. Anyway, with that in mind, let me call upon Paul, WS2N, to give the SpaceNet report.
Paul, one nanosecond. Can you start with DART? D-A-R-T.
Okay. And can I start with what? I missed that.
An acronym, DART. Delta, Alpha, Romeo, Tango.
Oh, okay. The DART mission. Okay, yeah, we'll do that. And, yeah, this is WS2N. And, oh, by the way, Roy, that antenna that lays on the ground, was that the Harvey snake antenna?
Yes, indeed. I keep forgetting it, but it was kind of famous on the TechNet, right?
Yeah, Dick used to talk about that quite a bit. And he had a story behind the guy that came up with this, you know. He always had a good story so that you wouldn't forget. Meanwhile, I forgot. I forgot the story. I remember the name of the antenna. But there you go. Yeah, the DART mission is... the one that was launched end of last year, and that's on the way to those two asteroids. That, one asteroid is orbiting the other asteroid, and the idea is to crash into the smaller one as fast as they can. I think it's going to hit it like 15,000 miles an hour, some ridiculously high speed. And the whole spacecraft is going to hit. It's not like they're going to have a piece separate and hit it. They've done that before with another mission. They had this big, heavy copper thing that separated from the mothership and crashed into another asteroid type of deal, but this is definitely, the spacecraft itself is going to smash into it, and before they do that, they're going to drop off a camera, so a camera will be floating behind this whole deal, and it will take a picture of the results, and then another year later, European Space Agency is supposed to launch another mission to go to the same location, and that will also have a camera on it that will take better pictures with spectrometers on it and all kinds of equipment to analyze the big crater that they put into this asteroid. The idea is to change the path of this double asteroid. They're trying to, by hitting this one smaller asteroid, that will actually slow it down a little bit. When I say slow, it'll take a longer period of time for it to orbit the bigger one. It'll become a little bit more elliptical, which means that the strongest point of gravity between the two will be located in a different place than where it was before the DART mission crashed into it. By doing that, the gravity will pull it more into one direction. They want to see if they could actually, move this, a degree or so, whatever it is. And then they'll measure it over time to see how they did. Is that the mission you were talking about, Ed?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, that's supposed to take place, I think the next spring. I'll have to check my notes. That will definitely make the news. I noticed that was the news topic when it launched. The news media loves that stuff. How many movies are made with asteroids crashing into the Earth, right?
My point exactly, there's one plane right now, and I think that a lot of people would be fascinated by this.
Oh, I agree. And are you thinking of the movie Don't Look Up?
Yes, my point exactly is that when I saw it, it reminded me, wait a minute, we are actually addressing this seriously, and the current incarnation is the DART mission.
That's right. And it's really quite a movie. It's serious, but I don't know, I found it funny at times, of course. But I guess you would call it black humor, something like, relating in a way to politics, they have quite a bit of that in there. In other words, don't tell the public too much. We don't want the public to freak out. It's one of those deals. It's very similar to what's kind of going on today with vaccines and masks and all of that. I saw a connection between that. Did you, Ed?
There's no two ways about it. It is a bitter, sarcastic addressing of those very issues. I don't think this is the place to go into much more detail about that, but what I do want to say is they use the metaphor of the asteroid to do their bitter cynicism, which, by the way, literary types would recognize. I think it's the same thing as Jonathan Swift, the guy who wrote Gulliver's Travels, wrote A Modest Proposal, which was a paper. At the time in England, there were a lot of kids in orphanages, and he wrote this bitter, cynical, sarcastic thing about the way these kids were being abused by suggesting the way to solve the problem is to cook and eat them. it's kind of along those same lines. But the point I'm saying is I think there are a lot of people who are freaking out about this who would be very reassured to know, in reality, we are addressing this problem seriously.
Yeah, right, that's right. And, my guess it's going to work. And I don't know how many articles I had to read to try to figure out how was this going to work, but, you know, when you change the period, the amount of time when the small asteroid goes around a larger asteroid, it wasn't only changing the time. To me, that really didn't mean anything. But if, let's say if it was a perfect circle, if you changed the period, it wouldn't do much. But if you change it, not only the time, but made it slightly more elliptical, that means the closest point when it gets to the other asteroid, that's the strongest pull of gravity. That location will change instead of being, you know, where it used to be, you know, it might be a few degrees off, and now it's that pull of the one small asteroid on the larger asteroid will pull both of them, you know, off its trajectory. So I thought that was pretty good. And by the way, this movie is very good. Jennifer Lawrence is in it, and unfortunately, right now, I believe you need Netflix. I don't know if it's in a movie theater, but it's definitely on Netflix. Any other comments there?
Yes, it is on Netflix, but no, my point is, yeah, I know what I want to say. Yeah. They picked this dual asteroid system because I think it lent itself very well to the test. And what it is they have very, very well understood dynamics of how these two orbit each other and move through, I guess it's the asteroid belt or wherever. And I am sure they have done calculations to say what the impact should do. And what they want to do is verify that they understand the physics of the situation, and they will compare what happens with what they predicted. And hopefully they'll line up, and if not, they have some work to do.
That's for sure. Yeah. I think it's one of these. I'll have to check. I think it's a near-Earth object, which there's a whole group of them that are elliptical to begin with. They'll come near Earth and then go out, to the asteroid belt, but not in that real circular orbit like the rest of the asteroid belt is. And these are the ones that they worry more about, just over time that of course changes, and someday in the future, you know, you might have one of the near-Earth asteroids actually hit the Earth. And if we know about it, you know, years in the future, you know, maybe we'll be able to do something. And this is one test, which should be interesting. Problem is, you know, this is a double asteroid, which they do have binaries. But you know what? They'll have to come up with another idea with just a plain old asteroid heading our way. But hey, this is a start, like you said. Very good. Glad you brought that up.
Oh, and related thing, you don't have to go back 66 million years ago. I have an idea, Paul. On your next vacation, take your time machine, go back 25,000 years, and put down Winslow, Arizona, and see what happens.
Yeah, right. Take out that crater. What is that? 2 miles in diameter or so. 12 miles. I don't know. I forget what it is. There's a lot of famous pictures of that. That thing when it hit, and they can't find the asteroid itself. I mean, this thing was like blown to bits when it hit the Earth. You know, it completely disintegrated more or less. You know, it's not like they can go down there and find this thing buried in, underneath the crater. But And you bring that up on any computer and look at that. It's amazing. All right, let me just go through a few of these topics that I had. Unless somebody has any other questions before we start, that's a good way to do it, too. This WS2M to the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Yeah, okay. If anybody ever sees anything in the news and they're wondering about it, you know, we can talk about it. And if I don't know about it, I'll find out about it for next week, like what happened last week. There was this one fellow on, John, I haven't heard him on tonight. I think it was NQ1U. He asked about the size of the dish antenna for the James Webb Space Telescope. And I was thinking back when this thing first started coming out 15, 20 years ago, they were calling it the next generation telescope, and at that time it was X-band, and it was going to be a larger, you know, maybe 4 or 5 foot dish antenna. But over the decades in the development and over time, they figured out that they would like to use the Ka band for transmitting from Webb. So I'm here to correct that anyway. 2 foot diameter dish, you know, roughly 60 centimeters in diameter. That's what they're using. Which, you know, using Ka, they're able to use a small dish, a smaller transmitter power. They can go as low as 5 watts. I was reading on a traveling wave tube, but higher than that. They're able to transmit over 8 millibits per second. This way they're going to get gigabit, actually over a day, twice a day, they're going to get gigabytes of data transmitted down with the Ka band, which is, I forget how many more times the amount of data than X band, but, you know, it's a substantial difference, you know, maybe 5-10 times different than the Ka band. So that's what they're using. They have actually two antennas mounted on the high gain actuator. It's a high gain platform that's attached to the bus, or the main part of the space, James Webb Space Telescope. And this way, this high gain platform could turn, you know, any which way, you know, if the telescope is pointing one way, this thing could adjust itself and point that high gain antenna directly toward Earth. And it's really a dual band system. You have an S band antenna and an S band radio, and you also have the Ka. And it can be used simultaneously. You can be transmitting from Earth on the S band, telling James Webb what to do, and at the same time James Webb could be transmitting all the data that it's gotten, you know, for the last 24 hours at the exact same time. That could be coming back on the Ka band. So there we go. We'll see how they do. I mean, it's working fine now. There's plenty of transmissions going back and forth. All the telemetry, the information all about the motors and everything that had to work to set this thing up in the first place, 800 different movements had to be created to open up this telescope to as big as a tennis court. You know, for the sun shield, and as big as a little over 21 feet for the gold-plated 18 hexagon mirrors that presently are being adjusted to, right now they have 18 points of light that came back on a CCD that's looking at this, which they expected, and that will eventually adjust each mirror at one time. Every mirror has six motors on it to adjust, you know, rocket one way or the other. And then there's a seventh mirror in the middle, which can actually put tension on the whole mirror itself to change its curvature focus. By the time that they're all done, all these 18 dots will eventually become one little dot on the charge couple device that they're working with right now. There's four detectors, four different things that are going to be used, four instruments that will pick up all this data. And I send it back down past the shield of the 5 mylar shield into the radio transmitter. Yes, S-band receiver. Actually, it's receiver receives and transmits on the S-band and then the KA as well. Any questions or comments? I guess John is not on this evening. Otherwise, he would have. I'm sure he would have transmitted. But if we hear him again, I'll repeat the whole thing for him. because I think he went away thinking that it was X-band. Okay, on another topic, the International Space Station, they do many, many experiments, hundreds, if not thousands, over the last, turn of the century. They started in 2000. But one of the experiments I like is they've done this before, but now they're getting a little bit more advanced. There's a robot on Earth. It's got like four wheels, but it's got this big arm, this actuating arm. It's bigger than a golf cart. And it's in the Netherlands, inside of a building. They have it in this big area filled with dirt and all kinds of rocks and different things. And it's got a robotic arm attached to it. And what they've done is they've linked this robotic arm to the International Space Station so that an astronaut on board the ISS could actually operate this robot that's sitting on Earth in the Netherlands. The one astronaut just recently did is Luca Pamitano. He's from the European Space Agency, presently on the space station. It's his second trip up. And he was the guy, I'm surprised he went up for a second trip. He was the guy that went on an EVA one time and got water in his helmet and became a dangerous situation back in 2013. They had to get him back inside. I figured, well, that's it. He's not going to go up. Meanwhile, he couldn't get on there fast enough to get back up to the ISS. Anyway, he's able to use this robotic arm. And one of the reasons they're running this test is eventually you could have astronauts in orbit around the moon or Mars or any different location with robots. Robotic equipment on the surface, and from orbit, they'll be able to use a hand operating system to be able to do things, maybe build things, move things. Who knows what they want to do, but they'll have that capability. You really can't do that from Earth, even with the moon. You have this 1.5 second delay. That wouldn't work out. I remember the very last Apollo mission, Apollo 17. They tried it on a previous mission as well. They wanted to take a picture of the ascent module taking off from the moon. They thought that, boy, that would be really cool to do. And to do it, the last three missions anyway had a rover. They had rovers on those missions, and those rovers had cameras on it, and they had you know, a dish antenna as well. So they could actually transmit directly back to Earth. So they said, this would be neat. Well, you know, we can take this camera, and, and the camera had motors on it, so it's actuated. So, you know, you could change the azimuth, the elevation as well. So they set the rover in a certain location, and the motor, to change its elevation, had to be controlled from Earth. You know, nowadays I'm sure this will all be digitally done and, you know, pre-programmed into the software. But in 1974, the last mission was 74, Apollo 17, they wanted to do it. We tried it on 16, it didn't work out. The operator on Earth had to joystick this more or less as the ascent module took off from the surface. So sometimes you'll see a clip on TV or documentary where, you know, the ascent module is taking off from the moon and going up, and it's following it. The camera's following it as it goes up. Who did that? Did they leave the guy back on the moon? No, they had this camera attached to the rover, and this guy joysticked it. And on that last mission, he nailed it. He was able to adjust it. He had his time just right. And, you know, he had a plan for that second and a half difference, you know. He knew when it was going to take off, so he would start moving it, you know, before it launched. Anyway, it worked, and they got that terrific picture. So you could imagine, you couldn't operate regular robot equipment from Earth, but you can from orbit. You know, you're only, if you're in low Earth or low lunar orbit, you're 62 miles above the surface. So you could joystick it almost anything on the surface of the moon, or even Mars if you're walking around Mars. So Lou Pomitano was able to manipulate this robot in the Netherlands, no problem. And they had something called haptic feedback. Haptic feedback is where people that play video games might have something like that, where you can feel in your hand, you can feel different things vibrate, whatever it is. Anyway, you could feel the tension and whatever it might be, however they have it programmed. And he was able to do that with this haptic feedback system, which I think is pretty cool. So, you know, you'd be able to pick up a rock and say, it feels like I'm picking up a rock. So, anyway, that went very well. And that's all done by European Space Agency. They have their own, like, mission control in Domhurst, Germany, and they're able to do stuff very similar to what we do in mission control in Houston. Any questions? WS2M.
Paul, WB3AV, with a comment from earlier.
WB2EAB, go ahead.
Yeah, I looked up on the internet the particulars of Meteor Crater in Winslow, Arizona. You want me to give you a 30-second report?
Yeah, I'm trying to memorize it. I can see the picture. I want to say it's a mile and a half across. Is that right?
4,000 feet across, and they say it got hit by a mostly iron meteorite 150 feet wide, and the crater was originally 750 feet deep, but this happened during the Ice Age, and it wasn't a desert then, and by the time it became desert, it was only like 400 feet deep. No, 750, that kind of was like in a foresty area. And then when the Ice Age ended, it became a desert. It kind of stabilized. They say 550 feet.
and it was only about 50,000 years ago, so no dinosaurs were around looking at that. You might have had indigenous people looking up, watching this damn thing come through the atmosphere.
Unlikely. It is believed that humans did not settle that area until 25,000 years ago after they crossed over from the Bering Strait, you know, from Asia. But yeah, they mention mammoths, mastodons, giant sloths, and it probably ruined their entire day.
Oh, okay, so yeah, some kind of creatures were wandering around looking up, huh? Okay. Very good, thanks for that. What happened? Did they say what happened to the asteroid? I remember it just blew apart and dissipated. Is this the one that... No, let's see. No, the other one, the one that was the one that killed the dinosaurs, that was 60 million years ago, but that's the one that spread iridium around the globe. But, yeah, I don't know what happened. What happened to the asteroid?
If you're talking about Winslow, Arizona, it was a meteorite. They believe it was mostly iron. You know, the Hayden Planetarium has a couple of, like, you know, 20-ton iron meteorites there. And, what'd they say? Something like... I can't find it right now. But the bottom line is, they're saying if you take the ground for a few miles around it, the ground is very different chemistry than it is 10, 20 miles away, with lots of iron and, not surprisingly, like sandstone and the like that the impact dug up. So basically, it just shattered the meteorite and, millions of tons of, you know, rock and the molten iron settled over about a 10-mile radius circle.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I remember reading stuff like that. So this meteor came down, probably wiped out, you know, maybe hundreds of miles around it, you know. If it wasn't a desert then, what was it? It was in the middle of the Ice Age, so you mean to tell me this thing, okay, that means there was no growth or anything around? Everything, you know, I would imagine everything would just light up on fire. All the trees would get knocked down if there were any trees. That's what happened with Tunguska, Russia, when that thing hit the, what year was that? Early 1900s, 1908. That one, like, blew up and never really hit the ground. As it came into the atmosphere, it just exploded and just knocked all the trees down. So, different meteorites do different things, I guess. Okay, Ed, thanks for that.
A couple of things. The Tunguska one, I think they decided it left no residue at all. I think it was like an ice comet that just from the stress of, traveling through the atmosphere and getting hot, it exploded and just leveled everything. All the residue basically melted and evaporated because it was basically like water or methane. About Winslow, Arizona, I think they had the impression it was like an Arctic tundra when it hit because of the ice age, but it wasn't like it was had to go through a mile through glacier. You know, it probably was, you know, a foot of snow on the ground.
Yeah, that must have been something. Yeah, that's a popular site. Millions of people have probably seen that. I haven't. Gone through Arizona, actually. I never went there, though. Anyway, there's a couple of flights I wanted to mention that are coming up. There's the Axiom commercial crew flight that's coming up this March, the end of March 31st. It's a planned mission. And this you know, there were no NASA people on this. There was an ex-NASA astronaut who will be commanding it. They're flying in a Falcon 9 crew vehicle.